Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. On today's episode, IBM, eBay, Amazon, Google, TikTok, the layoffs in tech just keep coming. Employment consultant Jason Greer says AI is at play.
Oh, the white-collar workers are in trouble.
Tech is shaking up its own labor market.
As opposed to paying somebody $200,000, $300,000 a year to do the job, I can actually use artificial intelligence to do the job that they used to be able to do.
And former interim speaker, Representative Patrick McHenry, on the push for progress in Congress as we gear up for the general election.
We can still do big deals, even amidst the longest general election campaign in American history.
Those conversations, but first, the real GDP number buoying economic spirits and Tesla's fourth quarter miss. CNBC's Phil LeBeau has the report.
There really wasn't a whole lot to like in this, guys, largely because of how vague they are about vehicle deliveries.
I'm CNBC producer Cameron Costa. It's Thursday, January 25th, and Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue it, please.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live from the Nasdaq market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here we go. It's a Thursday, and if you check out the U.S. equity.
First up on today's podcast, a big number from the Commerce Department. GDP, the measure of all goods and services produced, increased at a 3.3 annualized rate in the last quarter of 2023.
Some of the numbers weren't hot, but the GDP number, 3.3, is like amazingly good, isn't it?
It's very good, Joe.
3.3 is a slower rate than the quarter before, but it's still better than expectations. Overall, for 2023, the economy accelerated at a 2.5% pace, which is much better than what Wall Street had expected in the beginning of the year. Much of the growth this past quarter and through 2023 was driven by consumer spending. But not all the numbers were hot, as Joe said. Inflation is drifting slowly closer to the Fed's target rate of 2%, but we'll get the central bank's preferred inflation metric on Friday, so look out for that. We asked a panel of economists to react to this report on Thursday, including Joe Lavorgna, who was chief economist at the White House National Economic Council during President Trump's administration.
So I'd be careful to describe this economy as booming or blockbuster or anything like that, but the GDP data by themselves, no question, look better.
Bharat Ramamurthy was also on the panel. He was on the National Economic Council, too, although he served under President Biden. Ramamurthy says the pessimism is undue, and from where he sits, we're playing down a strong recovery.
Real wages are up for the last several months, quite strongly over the rate of inflation. I think that leads to a more resilient, sustainable recovery.
Now, real wages might be up for the last few months, but cumulatively, they've been down. And it's tough for Americans who keep feeling squeezed at the grocery store and, well, everywhere else. Our own Rick Santelli weighed in.
You're not going to brag about the economy when everything everybody buys on a day-to-day basis that makes less than about 100 grand a year is starting to continually feel it in their wallets.
And that's it. Stay tuned for Friday's PCE report.
Tesla shares under pressure after the EV company narrowly missed earnings estimates and warned that its expansion will be notably lower this year. Phil LeBeau joins us right now with more. And Phil, those words notably lower were their words, and I think that's part of the concern.
Yeah, that's the concern, Becky. Also, most people expected, I shouldn't say everybody, but most people expected Tesla to give us some kind of a number in terms of deliveries for 2024. Instead, you got notably lower growth in 24 than in 23. So let's talk about the numbers first, and then let's talk about the outlook. They did miss on the top and the bottom line, but the gross auto margins, excluding the zero emission vehicle credits, they came in better than expected. 17.1%, the street was expecting 15.7%, but there's the key right there. 2024 deliveries, the company says they will be notably lower, slower growth in 24 than in 23 in terms of how much deliveries grow annually. When you look at their annual deliveries, they hit 1.8 million last year. They were up 24% in 23. Go back to 22, they were up 40%. Now you're not sure how much they're going to grow in 2024. Here's Elon Musk on the conference call talking about why the slowdown is happening as they transition to the next generation vehicle they plan to build.
The first manufacturing location for this will be at our Gigafactory and headquarters in Austin, Texas. And then we'll follow that up with other locations around the world. Probably the factory we'll build in Mexico will be second. And then we'll be looking to identify a third location, perhaps by the end of this year or early next, outside of North America.
Left unsaid during the conference call was the fact that the EV market overall, for all automakers, it is slowing down in terms of the rate of growth relative to what we saw in 2023. It's still growing, just not as quickly. Tesla finished 23 number one in global EV sales, but in the fourth quarter, it was topped by BYD out of China. And during the call, Elon Musk talked not just about Chinese EV companies, but Chinese automakers overall, and the fact that they are expanding rapidly around the world. They're very good. And if the world, in terms of countries, are not prepared with trade restrictions, that the Chinese are going to demolish. And that's the word that Elon Musk used, demolish the competition. The energy storage business, a bright spot in the report, up 30% year over year. But there really wasn't a whole lot to like in this, guys, largely because of how vague they are about vehicle deliveries happening in 2024. How much are they going to grow?
I guess that's better than making numbers up when it's a pretty hazy outlook. Phil, we were just talking about it off camera. Joe was making the point that if you can't move Teslas, it just is indicative of the EV market overall. You saw some huge growth, some pushes behind it, but this is going to be a very different year for everybody.
And remember, they have a different dynamic in terms of the Gigafactory in Shanghai and the competition that they are facing in China from the electric vehicle companies over there. And the overall market for autos in China has been slowing down. And so you have this capacity that is there that the Chinese automakers are saying, well, first of all, we got to boost our sales at home. Let's force others to cut their prices. And by the way, we still have extra capacity. Let's start shipping these vehicles around the world. That's what he's talking about in terms of the Chinese automakers, not just when it comes to EVs, but the overall market.
Hey, Phil, are you going to bring us or drive a Yang Wang U9? Have you seen that? The ultra EV sports car from BYD? I mean, they're serious about
this. I've seen it.
Is it a good car?
I assume that's what Elon Musk
BYD is a great company, Joe. Everybody
cool
that
looking.
I've talked with who has spent time, they're cool looking. And the quality is there, not just with BYD, but with a number of the Chinese EVs. I've been in them. In Europe, you're not seeing these Chinese EVs, and you won't see them around here anytime soon.
Hey Phil,
given the trade restrictions that we have.
Phil, I love the honesty.
Say that again.
I love the honesty that Elon had on that call, which was to say, if we don't do something about tariffs, these cars are pretty great. You're going to have to do something here. But at the same time, I'm thinking to
myself,
Elon has a huge business in China. Aren't the Chinese looking at him saying that?
Yeah,
saying,
because he's walked a very tight
what is going on
fine
here?
Line to this point.
Sure, they are looking at him. And look, Tesla imports EVs that are made in China into North America. They're brought into Canada. Some of the models that are built in China are brought into Canada and sold in Canada. We don't bring EVs built in China into the U.S. because of the trade restrictions. There's a 25% tariff. So it would make it prohibitive for a company to build a vehicle or for Chinese automakers to build in China and then ship over here to the United States. But that's what he's talking about. If you don't put some of these restrictions in place, you can look around the world. And I've been in Europe. I know you guys have been in Europe. I am sure when you guys were over at Davos, if you took an Uber, you probably were taking a Chinese vehicle. I did. Last time I was in Europe, me and my producer were in Chinese vehicles, all of the Ubers.
Hey, Phil, very quickly, you talk about BYD's quality. I'd love to get your opinion on the latest with Boeing, the quality issues there, what this means, how serious this is.
It's very serious. Look, they can't expand production until the FAA is satisfied that the culture, the safety culture at Boeing is 100% better. I mean, that's being very blunt about it. The FAA is looking at Boeing right now and saying, you got to do the basics of blocking and tackling a lot better than what you've been doing in the past. And it's not enough to say that we're going to put inspectors and we're going to improve things. We want to see it. We want to see proof that you are improving your safety culture. And that's why they're limiting production. That production limit, it'll be interesting to see what Boeing says next week about its guidance long term. Remember, they plan to get up to 50 per month in terms of max production by 2025, 2026. That's also going to be driving the free cash flow target that they've set out there. I think it's $10 billion annually in 25, 26. Does that change now? And if that changes, that probably changes your outlook as an investor in terms of, well, okay, am I going to hang on to Boeing here and wait for it to finally kick in terms of the free cash flow? This is a significant move by the FAA.
Hey, Phil, I saw conflicting things yesterday. Who assembled the fuselages? I saw some stories that it wasn't Spirit, that Boeing had actually put the plug back on some of the
fuselages. That was a report out of the Seattle Times that the work on the door plug in question on the Alaska Airlines plane,
Boeing.
The one that was ripped off.
Is that not true?
Well, the NTSB has not made a final determination. We reached out to Boeing. Boeing says it has no comment while the NTSB investigation is going on.
It was crazy.
Look,
it said that
Dave
the bolts were left off, it said, not just not tightened, and that Boeing had messed up the...
But that, Joe, we should point out, that report was based on an anonymous...
Whistleblower.
Whistleblower, anonymous, single-sourced. I mean, could it be true? Possibly, yeah, but we're waiting to see what the NTSB says.
Okay. All right, as long as we characterize it like that, but it was out there. I saw I was like flabbergasted.
Yes, that was the Seattle Times report. And look, it may be that's ultimately the case. We will probably hear from the NTSB in terms of like a tentative findings of the investigation. My guess is probably sometime in the next few weeks. They will come out with some type of tentative findings. That's not the final root cause of everything, but that's likely what we're going to see.
But the Alaska Air guy is definitely not happy, the CEO.
I don't blame him. Would you be happy?
No.
You take a brand new plane, and then you're sitting at, have you seen the interview with him? He's sitting at dinner, and then he sees pictures of a chunk of the plane ripped off.
How the heck does a door plug blow out midair at 16,000 feet? When I found out it was a MAX 9, and only 10 weeks out of the factory, I knew we needed to make a swift decision, and which is why I decided to ground the MAX within a few hours. I'm more than frustrated and disappointed. I am angry.
A brand new plane.
A brand new plane for 2 months has been there. And now they're saying go back and check all the bolts and the sliders. And it's like self-assembly. I don't know. Phil, thank you.
In yesterday's State of the City address, New York Mayor Eric Adams announcing the city's declared social media a public health threat.
We also need to protect our students from harm online, including the growing dangers presented by social media. Companies like TikTok, YouTube, Facebook are fueling a mental health crisis by designing their platforms with addictive and dangerous features. We cannot stand by and let big tech monetize our children's privacy and jeopardize their mental health.
Mayor Adams calling on state and federal lawmakers to do more to curb what he called predatory practices of some social media companies. He said the city would treat social media like other health hazards. I don't know. You know, my kids are now teenagers, and it's like an
epidemic. Not all
like,
of them.
Not all of them yet, but it's like an epidemic in my house now. It is. And I don't think I appreciated the challenges and problems that social media can create. Really.
This is what you know about, too, and you can't know everything.
Well, that's a whole separate issue.
This is something I've been upset about for a long time. However, I think New York City probably has bigger issues that they're facing at the moment.
Well, that's for sure.
This is a sleight of hand for him. I'm bothered that Congress has not done anything to protect children from this front. It's been a long time coming. Right. It's the bullying. It's the way you feel about your body, body image issues that go with all of these things. The bullying is terrible.
Teenage boys? I don't even want to think of what I'd be.
If you had it when you were a teenager?
Yes.
Yes. But I do think New York City has a lot of bigger issues.
I'd be more screwed up than I already am. I think more warped.
It's a national problem, though. I think it needs to be dealt with at the
I didn't immediately say that's ridiculous. Yeah. What the mayor just said, I didn't say that, or it's...
Because I don't think it is ridiculous. I do think, other problems.
Or nanny state or anything like that. I sort of feel him on that.
In political news, a source tells CNBC that billionaire Reid Hoffman does not plan to give any more money to Nikki Haley's presidential campaign after her loss in the New Hampshire primary. Hoffman reportedly gave $250,000 to a pro-Haley super PAC last year. He has said that he's a supporter of President Biden, but believed Haley had the best chance of beating former President Trump in the Republican primary contest. Other fundraisers told CNBC yesterday that they planned to speak out publicly in support of Haley, but weren't convinced that they'd be able to raise much money for her campaign because of her losses in the first two nominating contests.
It's fine. People can have. I understand why people have just the most strongest hysterical TDS, but I read what he said. He actually said there's two elections involving Trump, and since we got two, I want to do all I can with both to make sure that he never gets anywhere near. Yeah. So just from the outside chance that Nikki Haley could actually win, to knock him out there, he was giving money. And then, again, he'll give, I'm sure, during the general election, but he had two chances to stop him, and he was not a Nikki Haley supporter.
He was open about that, too.
I know, it's funny.
Well, but this is why, Barry Diller was a supporter of Chris Christie.
No, I don't.
Yeah. Why?
I know.
And by the way, I think he actually genuinely liked Chris Christie, but he liked also Chris Christie because Chris Christie had made his campaign about trying to undermine former President Trump.
Exactly.
Separately, the United Auto Workers Union is endorsing President Biden for re-election. UAW President Sean Fain announced that decision yesterday at a union conference in Washington, D.C. Back in May, Fain said the union would withhold an endorsement for Biden until concerns about the industry's transition to all-electric vehicles were addressed. Yesterday, very strong words in support of President Biden.
And this choice is clear. Joe Biden bet on the American worker, while Donald Trump blamed the American worker. I'm proud to stand up here with your International Executive Board and announce that the UAW is endorsing Joe Biden for President of the United States.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, we're heading into the general election, but there's legislative gridlock in Washington. Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Representative Patrick McHenry, and the House's interim speaker between Speakers McCarthy and Johnson, spoke to us on the push and pull of getting deals done.
We have a moment right now where congressional leaders need to understand you should not fear the deal.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Joe Kernan along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. The last hour of Thursday might be the best time, the nadir, don't you think? Is nadir top or bottom? I think it's top, isn't it?
Top, isn't it?
I think that might be it because tomorrow's Friday.
And that's way too close to Monday.
Too close to Monday.
Yep.
We're not done, but we're almost, but we love being here with you, all of us together. Our next guest was interim speaker following the ousting of former speaker Kevin McCarthy and has announced he won't be seeking re-election in 2024. Joining us now, Congressman Patrick McHenry, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. You got a ways to go. So you're
I got another year.
You do. And you still got constituents that you need to look out for their interests. What does that entail in terms of crypto? What does that mean you need to do?
Well, I've got, when the House basically attempted to commit political suicide, Republicans in the House tried to commit political suicide in the fall, it gummed up 3 or 4 months of House floor action. So I've got major policies on capital formation, data privacy, and crypto that we haven't moved across the House floor, and I intend to get those moved across the House floor this year. We can still do big deals. We can still do big deals, even amidst the longest presidential campaign, general election campaign in American history. We can still get these things done and build consensus. And I think there's a need for market structure on crypto.
The recent ETF and watching the SEC chair sort of kicking and screaming, really, after the court said one thing. And is that... That's no way to run a railroad, is it?
It's ineptitude. And they went kicking and screaming after the courts demanded they take this action. Now you have more legitimate money coming in, flowing into crypto, some structure being provided to a new asset class that has its problems and needs some clarity under federal law to remedy it. But what you see out of Gensler, he's got 62 rulemakings he intends to do this year. You have this backdrop of regulatory policy for this administration that is problematic for them, and they're having a hard time rebranding what their economic policy is, to the point where they're sending administration officials out to try to convince the American people that what they feel, they should not actually feel.
Right.
And that's a tough thing in a political year.
Well, I've watched, you know, we can take this interview wherever you want to go, the Crazy Eight, and I don't know what Speaker Johnson's future looks like. I don't know how we fund Ukraine and the border, and there's all kinds of, I don't know what you'd call it. People are there's histrionics and backflips trying to get this done. But I will, they do stick to a message. I'm talking about Democrats with this immigration. I've watched the president's press secretary say it's Republicans' fault because of that supplemental. We're going to hire a few more border people. So it has nothing to do with President Biden. And I watched Chris Coons say the same thing yesterday, that Republicans, it's all Republicans' fault, the porous border down there, because the Senate didn't take up or did not vote on that supplemental.
So let's unpack that. That's two questions. Let's start with the border. Because I think that is a powerful issue. It's a powerful issue for the American people. Those border states and then interior states are experiencing, and this city is experiencing something that under the Trump administration, they wouldn't have talked the same game. And so the politics have shifted because the experience is different for the American people. And this is a political problem for the Democrat president running for election. So they've come to the table on border policy. Now, we don't know the full contents of what they're talking about in the Senate, so I'm not going to prejudge that.
Do they want to close the border or do they want to process more people? Did you see how many getaways there are every day? That's impossible.
Well,
800 a day.
It's dollars. They withheld the dollars during the Trump administration, and that was not what stopped the flow of the southern border. It was the Remain in Mexico policy that was the powerful driver, and then saying, if you come here, we'll send you back. And that's presidential leadership and a change of policy. It's not really large dollars that we're talking about here. So that's where the Democrats are off kilter.
Is there a negotiating position
for Ukraine?
To meet on that idea of not dollars, but just the idea of the message you're going to send out?
What I'm hearing from the Senate is that they still don't get that message. This is not 50 complex ideas. It's a two or three policy changes, right, and a small amount of dollars, because there is a humanitarian piece to this that is real. Sure. You have human lives at stake.
Someone dies every day.
But we have a moment right now where congressional leaders need to understand you should not fear the deal. You should get as much good in public policy as your time.
Okay, that's exactly
gets.
It. The idea
Without
that nobody wants to give the other side a win, I think, is what has gotten to us this horrific position.
And we're
logical
now,
people
right,
can find
30 years on immigration policy of that very dynamic.
But unless I'm misunderstanding, there was the report this morning, Punchbowl, Jake Sherman, suggesting that Mitch McConnell made some comments that effectively said, we need to separate. He was in for Ukraine and border and everything together. Right. And effectively, he's now saying we need to separate it out. Former President Trump is going to be our candidate. He wants to make immigration the central issue. And therefore.
But I don't think he wants much to get done on this front.
Right. And he wants nothing. But that's the point. It becomes a political story. If I'm reading the Sherman story properly and understanding what Mitch McConnell is saying, if it's reported accurately, it effectively now suggests truly that politics is playing a role in this that is even. But I mean, at a level that is.
Right.
is
even more than in the past.
Right.
There's gambling at this casino. I mean, come on. But there's politics.
But none of us should be happy about that.
No. And actually,
even though it's a reality, I recognize
that. That is a couple of mismanagements in November and December have led to these ramifications in January to March. And so we should have gotten this done before Christmas. This should have been done before Christmas. The dynamics were the same. The equities were the same. The politics a little bit better before coming up on Super Tuesday,
right,
or what we saw in New Hampshire and in Iowa. So getting it done beforehand was better. The political dynamics of the push and pull on policy, still the same. So take the deal fast, get it over with, move on, and we can go fight it out like people normally fight it out. The key issue here, though, is are we going to take a policy win that Republicans have sought for 20 years to make things better,
mm-hmm,
the Democrats are saying we can't be very specific, so we need to hand this over to the executive branch to implement fully. Well, that's the implementation question for President Biden or President Trump. And candidate Trump should see that he could use those executive functions and do a better job at the southern border than Biden. And you can still have the fight about immigration. And the American people don't believe that Biden is tough on immigration. And they believe Trump is tough on immigration. Right. So the issue doesn't change.
Can I ask you a question? Are you a supporter? Are you a supporter of President Trump if, in fact, he becomes a nominee?
I haven't played in this zone. I've had a pretty complicated 2023.
No, I know.
And I'm retiring from Congress. But what we just saw.
But you made some comments after January 6th, if you go back and rewind the tape.
I stand by every word I said, but I'm a Republican. I want Republicans to win. So that's a complex thing. It's a difficult thing. I think the rule of law and the constitutional restraints in our society are massively important, more important than who gets elected. And that's what I'm going to uphold no matter what. But he is the de facto nominee. We are now in a long general election. Right. With the American people having... But
isn't there some part of you that says that you could vote independently of what has become, a cult on both sides? Meaning the idea that people say, whoever the nominee is on my side, it's like a religion. Whoever the nominee is on my side, I just vote for.
If it's a binary choice...
And that's fine. That's fine for you to have that.
You write in Ronald Reagan, he's not available.
No. But by the way, I think there are Democrats... who are unhappy with President Biden, who feel that President Biden is too old and
a whole host of things. You disagree it's a binary choice.
Who? Do I disagree that it's a binary?
Yes.
It is binary, but
it's a binary choice.
But
you have a choice of Biden or Trump. And he's a Republican,
but what I'm saying is I think there are Democrats.
You know, fifths and butts were candies and nuts. My grandmother would be my grandfather.
The distinction I'm trying to make is you have a number of, frankly, high-profile Democrats who are now trying to support Nikki Haley. We don't know whether she has a chance of becoming the nominee, but
I have an idea whether she does.
Okay. But I'm saying there's a
she's
a
down
sense,
30 points in
fine.
South
there's
Carolina.
A sense of there's some sense of independent thought beyond the sort of religious cultish approach to whoever is in the seat gets the choice.
Democrats should start first and not vote for someone who 4 years from now is not going to know. With Kamala Harris waiting, why don't you start first in voting your conscience and don't take the binary choice. Pick somebody else. Write in Mark
Warren. Like my two dads fighting over me. So, but back to this point. What has Biden done to show that he's going to moderate? Candidate Biden, Senator Biden, very different than the governing functions of this administration. They went to the progressive left on spending to ameliorate Bernie Sanders. They went to progressive left on regulatory policy and economic policy, regulatory policy to assuage the progressive left. What the hell is that in? What is there in there for a reasonable person to look at? The performance here is terrible. Economic performance is terrible. The spending is way too high.
I think there's
this
a relativity.
Not a moderate administration.
No, look, I think there's a lot of things that you can be critical about in fairness about this administration. No question. Having said that, I think there's a question, and you raised it yourself after January 6th, as did so many other Republicans, as did, frankly, virtually every single major name that worked in the Trump administration.
But you're just making a point that you think Trump's worse than Biden. And on the other side, they think Biden's worse than Trump.
I'm allowed to ask the question.
It's just your opinion. You've hated Trump for 6 years. I'm not happy about it either.
Chairman McHenry, let me ask you about something else. Getting back to the year you had in 2023, the speaker right now, how much support does he have? Does he get in trouble if he cuts a deal down the road? Does he wind up in the same position? Are you going to be back in the position of having to gavel this?
Speaker has got the unanimous support of the House Republicans on the House floor. That's a major statement. He should govern and go. He should not fear the deal. He should go. He should not delay because people are yelling at him, and some are. That's their negotiating tactic. That's been the way a number of these policymakers have tried to achieve their goals ineffectually. So he should not fear the deal. The slowing down, we're in the toughest piece of legislating, political legislating, second toughest, I would say. After negotiating the debt ceiling, you have the frame for how government spending is going to work. Go cut the deal. Get it done. Far better to get it done yesterday than tomorrow. and the politics get better for House Republicans and Republicans generally once you're done with that.
So you want strong leadership?
Yes. Go. Don't fear the deal. And the faster you can get done with that, the faster we recede in Washington and the focus becomes on this, what I would say is a binary choice, mm-hmm. the economic performance of this administration, national security, domestic security situation. And those are going to be the three major debates of this political year. Right. And then guys like me can come on and talk about boring policy
right.
early in the show and interesting people late in the show.
Next on Squawk Pod, IBM, eBay, Google, Amazon, the layoffs just keep coming in the tech sector. Career consultant Jason Greer discusses AI's impact on the labor market and on higher education.
If we could retool the way that we look at college, we could retool the way that colleges are basically doing this cash crunch on students that want to come to college, I think we could still utilize college for what it should be, and that's teaching people how to think.
You're listening to Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Andrew.
IBM and eBay are the latest tech companies announcing layoffs. Google, Amazon, and others announced cuts earlier this month. Joining us right now is Jason Greer, founder and president of Greer Consulting Group. I want to thank you for joining us. We have seen this wave of layoffs, Jason. I wonder whether you think these are idiosyncratic, whether you think this is the beginning of a wave. Whether you think that companies are just coming to the realization that they have been bloated. I mean, a lot of people talked about the bloat during the pandemic and then right. felt like they couldn't lay people off during that period. How do you assess this?
I think that the market rewards layoffs. I also think the fact that there's a certain amount of bloat that happened, especially after COVID, well, during COVID, where companies overhired. But I think there's something else at play. Artificial intelligence is really at play here. When you really look at the numbers of people that are being restructured or being laid off, you're looking at a lot of white collar jobs. But especially, and I'm going to speak directly to my human resources folks, 28% of the layoffs that have happened have been in human resources, largely the fact that artificial intelligence has made the automation of those jobs to the point where you no longer need those human resources professionals.
So you think AI has already hit the business effectively?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, especially in the tech sector. I mean, they've been talking about it for years. Now the fact that you have more companies moving toward artificial intelligence, and they're looking at the fact that as opposed to paying somebody $200,000, $300,000 a year to do the job, I can actually use artificial intelligence to do the job that they used to be able to do.
So what does this portend? I mean, do you think that we're going to start to, if you looked at the Fortune 500, would you think we're going to mm-hmm. see 10%, 20% layoffs? I mean, in terms of total numbers of employees at these companies over the next, call it, 2 or 3 years. What does that yes. look like to you?
Probably about 10% of the workforce is going to be laid off, especially when the fact that, again, the market rewards it. But that's just sort of the trend that we see ourselves going down.
Are there certain, I mean, we've talked about also the protected jobs. There are certain types of jobs. Oddly enough, people thought that blue collar workers were going to lose their jobs first. Now it may very well be the white collar workers.
Oh, the white-collar workers are in trouble. Let's talk about blue-collar workers. And I'll say this, and I say it again. That's why we need to start investing more money into trade schools. We need to start sending students into trade schools because blue-collar jobs are where it's at. White-collar jobs, on the other case, especially in middle management, sales, along the lines, those are the jobs that are being eradicated because people don't want to continue to pay the salaries for things that either artificial intelligence can do, or instead of hiring 5 people to do that job, I can cut it down to 2. And so I know that they'll do the work of 5 people.
How concerned, though, are you about, you know, there was a whole period of time everyone said you got to be an engineer. Everybody needs an engineering degree. Everybody poured into engineering. Now you're talking about AI effectively taking those engineering jobs. Now you and others are saying, hey, everyone's got to get reskilled so they can do a blue collar job. Well, you know, if Elon Musk has his way, he's going to have robots doing a lot of these jobs very soon. And you're
Absolutely.
Starting to see more and more of this. So in terms of trying to skate where the puck is or isn't, what would you really do?
I would take a look at what the market is rewarding. And right now, the market is still rewarding. Let's be honest. The market is still rewarding technical skills. The market is rewarding technology. It's rewarding coding. It's rewarding those kinds of things. I think ultimately, though, people need to take a look at the fact that corporations will utilize your skill set when they need you, and they will get rid of your skill set when they don't need you. So what I will tell people is invest in your side hustle, whatever the case might be. If You want to create your own job, you want to create your own business, that's what you do. Because if you're going to go into the market thinking that corporations are going to take care of you, they're just not, because there's no reason for them to do so.
What do you think about a college degree?
We told the
American public for the last 50 years, if you get a college degree, it's going to help you immensely. And I think there's a lot of people who feel like that was a myth.
I'm speaking to you as somebody who has three college degrees, a bachelor and two master's degrees. I think that college is still where it's at, because you don't go to college to get a job. You go to college to learn how to think. But on the other side of that, these colleges and universities need to stop charging $800,000 a year just so somebody can get a degree, only for them to come out making $17.50 an hour. It doesn't work. But again, if we could retool the way that we look at college, we could retool the way that colleges are basically doing this cash crunch on students that want to come to college, I think we could still utilize college for what it should be. And that's teaching people how to think.
Jason, always appreciate your perspective on all of it. And it's a little bit of a scary one right now. Thank you.
We'll get it. Thank you.
The California college system, university system right now, they're on strike. So you're paying for your kids to be out there living in a dorm.
And there's no classes.
Paying tuition. There's no classes. They have homework. They're teaching themselves.
Like, wow.
You got to be kidding me. They're in school for 7.5 months out of the year anyway, and they're on strike right now.
Similar during the pandemic. No one got refunds.
No one got any refunds for any of the stuff that happened. So now you've got the same kids who were dealt with the shortages during the pandemic where they weren't actually taught, who are now sitting through strikes where they're not being taught.
Could be worse. You could actually be in classes at some of those Ivy League schools. Which would be even worse than, like, Harvard.
That's the podcast for today. Thank you for tuning in. You can tune into Squawk Pod anytime as long as you follow us wherever you're listening now and turn on your downloads. We distill the best of our three-hour TV broadcast, Squawk Box, which is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin, weekday mornings on CNBC starting at 6 a.m. Eastern. We'll meet you right back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.